49. The reader can imagine how much Barbara enjoyed a second child showing up at her house, this one middle-aged, unemployed, and large. Jerry sang in the shower and snored like a bear. He was kind of hard to ignore. But she got no say in the matter because anything more than a full welcome would have called into question Charlie's claim that the house on Rust Road was his house, too. She might have owned it, might have paid its monthly mortgage, might have raised her two kids there, quietly sipping her morning coffee as I had observed her doing on the day of his surgery, but it was a sacred stipulation of their marriage contract that his children had the same right to call it home as she did. And out of deference to him, and out of love, the evil stepmother held her tongue. "I hope you know I'm not drowning in debt," Jerry said to me in passing one morning on the stairs. "I have several thousands socked away." "Is that true?" "I'm just running a little experiment. Is it or is it not Charlie's home, too? Will she or will she not abide one of his own flesh and blood children? What if I bring home a lady friend? What if that lady friend charges by the hour? So many outstanding questions, Jake. I suppose only time will tell."
"You're joking, right?
Does it matter if I have money or not?
I'm here.
One way or the other, we're about to find out what she's made of."
"She will never kick you out," I said. "She loves him too much."
"Oh," he said. "Have you started calling her mom yet?" I laughed. This light little ribbing, part of the casual exchange between two brothers as they passed each other on the stairs, was a breath of fresh air in that house of slumber and death. He retreated to Troy's old room like a surly teenager, and I resumed cleaning the bathrooms and doing the laundry. I might have returned to Rome once Jerry came to live in the house on Rust Road. Charlie didn't need two sons scrambling his eggs and driving him to his chemo sessions, but I stuck around. I liked the fact of the three of us under the same roof again, father and sons taking advantage of an unorthodox time to enjoy one another's company. I wouldn't have traded that for Rome or the Cotswolds or anywhere else in the world. If this section of my tale begins to feel sentimental, workmanlike in its efforts to memorialize, that is because I strain to capture the competing agendas and mindsets of that difficult time. Charlie, slogging through chemo, Jerry, humiliated and thrown back on his father and his fourth stepmother. Barbara, desperate to be done with him and me, and to return to her simple life in her simple home, going to work and doing crossword puzzles with her silver fox on Sundays, and fooling herself that it could go on like that forever. And me. And me. What did I want? I called Marcy in Deer Park to give her the latest. "The chemo's killing him," I said. "It's going after everything, right down to his eyebrows. It's the old story of the cure being worse than the disease." I could not say how I knew. I just knew. The Marcy I got that day was not in the mood and didn't give a damn.
"What do you want from me, Jake?" she asked.
"Pay him a little visit," I said. "It would do him a lot of good. He needs reasons to go on right now."
"And why do I care if he goes on?"
"He's your dad.
He doesn't have any money."
There was a long pause.
"What does that have to do with anything?" "A good dad does all he can to leave behind a little something for his children after he dies. Does he not?"
"Jesus, Marcy, the man's fighting for his life over here."
"What's that to you, Jake? What business is it of yours if I ever come home again? He hasn't earned this kind of slavish devotion from you, has he? A deluded old man? A man who dropped you?"
"He never dropped me."
"A man who's been dishonest his whole life, desperate to be loved by everyone, but more than happy to let his dick call the shots.
"Not so much anymore," I said. "He can't do half the things he used to do as a younger man."
"So I should forgive him? I should fly home and cheer him on because he can't fuck anymore?"
There was a long pause.
"What's really going on here, Jake?"
What was really going on was something I would no sooner share with her than Charlie would have shared his most delicate dream with his devouring younger brother. The energetic young father showing Jerry squirrels outside the window. A laundry-draped bathroom, as in the house on Vermilion. Jars of sun tea baking on the back porch stairs. Softball games in Douglas Park. Potlucks and backyard barbecues. Happy Necker manning a grill in Argyle and plaid. Picnic blankets, casks of cheap wine. A transistor radio playing AM standards from 1979. All the old friends, and all the old songs, and all the old feeling this family had before it went to shit. Why couldn't we remake a little of all that right here on Rust Road?
Why do you care so much? Why is this so important to you?
I knew my answer wouldn't satisfy her. Because I love you guys.
That's nice of you, she said. You're a really nice guy, Jake, but I'm gonna say this once, okay? And never again? Butt the fuck out.
50. The news that day was unbelievable. The one bank, the one estimable institution to have emerged unscathed from the subprime mortgage mess. Wells Fargo. Caught red-handed creating fraudulent accounts. Well, Charlie thought, folding up his newspaper, the Rat Fink bastards were back at it again. It was September of 2016. Almost 8 years to the day had passed since his Whipple procedure, and 3 years since he was declared cancer-free. He kicked the footrest to the floor. The living room, with its large square footage, stylish new furnishings, and tall, tall ceiling, stared back at him. Down at him, too. Discerning the full return of his organic gray locks. Though he hardly noticed, so lost in thought was he. It had been but a blink of the eye since Bear Stearns went down in flames. Lehman, too, went down. America itself damn near went down. Billions of dollars gone, millions of jobs shed, not to mention all the people who lost their homes. If there was one white hat in the whole damn stick-up, it was Wells. But turns out they, too, knew how to screw the pooch. He stood, and what he mistook for his imminent demise turned out to be just a minor backache. At the sun-drenched breakfast nook, a major selling feature of the new house, he sliced a grapefruit and sugared over the first of its open halves. Then he set about extracting its pink meat from nature's neat honeycomb with a serrated spoon while delving deeper into the whys and wherefores of the fraud at Wells Fargo. Soon his mouth went slack, his sharp spoon sat stilled in midair, and all that moved were his pale blue eyes as they flitted across the page. Under terrific pressure to fill quotas, the bank had opened thousands of unauthorized accounts, charging millions in clandestine fees. There, the story ended. His fever broke, and he sat back and shook his head in dismay. With a jolt upright, he recalled that he knew somebody who worked at Wells, his old friend Larry Stovall. Larry had worked there back in 08 anyway, when Bear went kaput. A cold snap hit credit markets, and Charlie was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Taking up his mug of tea, he walked under the exposed oak rafters, past the formal dining room and the wood-paneled library, and descended the stairs to the basement office. There, waiting for him inside his old battered Rolodex next to the rapier-style letter opener, holdovers from the house on Rust Road, was the most current number he had on file for Larry Stovall. He returned up the stairs with both the number and the cordless so that he might place his phone call in the heavenly sunlight saturating the breakfast nook that so made his old bones shiver and thrive. "Wells Fargo?" "Good morning," he said. "Charlie Barnes calling for Larry Stovall."
"I'm afraid Larry hasn't made it in this morning," the woman said. "May I take a message?"
"Old Larry," he said. The woman made no reply. "I was just reading about the scandal over there at Wells," he said, "when I was reminded of Larry. He and I worked at Bear Stearns together 100 years ago. I don't know if you remember Bear. No reason you should. It was a ship full of rat bastards back in 08, and sure enough it sank, damn near taking the rest of us down with it. Anyway, Larry and I had worked for a guy named... Little guy, not much to look at."
"Oh, good Lord," he said.
"What was his name?" Now that was odd. He had thought about that guy day and night at one point in time, saying his name in praise or blame to anyone who would listen, and now he couldn't recall it to save his life. He could bring to mind what he looked like, not much. Recall his affection for cigars and curse words, his $10,000 golf games, and how he led Bear Stearns into receivership while demanding a ransom from the American people, but he was blanking on his damn name. "Larry would remember," he said. "It sure did suck, seeing your mind go. But it wasn't just age. Charlie Barnes simply had no need to think so often of Jimmy Kane anymore."
"Would you like to leave a message for Larry?" the woman asked.
"Last time I left a message for Larry," he said, "it was 8 years ago, and I never heard back." There was no immediate reply. "I called to let him know I had pancreatic cancer. I have no idea how familiar you might be with that kind of cancer, but it almost always spells a swift end. Well, I defied the odds. I've made it 8 years. I have a new car now. I bought a new house. I even have a new job, but I should be dead."
"Well, how wonderful," the woman said. "You never know what life has in store, do you?"
"Unless it's death," he said. There was a long pause.
"Right," she said. "Is that the message you'd like me to leave for Larry today?"
In the lull that followed, he allowed himself to observe, with profitless abandon, the devastated grapefruit rind on the breakfast table, its cowlicked look when viewed at a distance, while up close it resembled one of those saturated landscapes in ruin after the water recedes, after the sun comes out and an eerie peace descends. He lost himself momentarily inside its fibrous and fascinating swales.
"Sir?"
"Sorry," he said. "Zoned out for a minute there."
"Would you like to leave a message for Larry?"
It was a real damn mess the last time he left messages for Larry Stovall, a total of 4, maybe 5, each one contradicting the last until it must have seemed to Larry a great farce. It was, too, those messages and that day and his life back then.
"Thank you, no," he said. "No message."
He hung up. The house on Harmony Drive came up for sale just last year in 2015. Built at the turn of the new century, it had 5 bedrooms and 4 baths, and at 4,000 square feet was twice the size of the house on Rust Road. He and Barbara had been flirting with the luxury tower downtown called the Legacy at Millennium Park, with its doormanned extravagance and floor-to-ceiling views of Lake Michigan. But for some reason, they drove to Oak Park one breezy Sunday in spring to have a look at 906 Harmony Drive. Potential buyers were always struck by the solemnity of the high ceilings.
Also unique were the eye-popping barnyard doors, sourced from Vermont, which opened onto the ground-floor library. Having mentally made the move downtown, they coolly appraised the rooms until Barbara walked into the kitchen and said, "Oh, Charlie, would you look?" And they both just knew. This was, in fact, every inch the paradise he'd dreamed of providing for her one day. Perhaps they weren't tower people after all, but heart and soul suburbanites. Make of that what you will, with an affection for lawns and neighbors. The breakfast nook, still lively with sunlight at noon, was set apart by delicate panes of glass with glazed mullions behind which the beautiful hedgerows bloomed. The real estate agent, a Dallas native in pearls and slacks, informed them that the empty lot next door was also for sale. They paid cash for that, planted bamboo for privacy at the landscaper's recommendation, and installed a pergola and bird bath. Charlie liked to take a glass of wine out there toward the end of the day. They parked what they still called Rabineau's Porsche, after the late mechanic, in the three-car garage. A mere 30 or so suburban miles from their former home, this new one combined the opulence of an Italian palazzo with the peace and quiet of a Zen garden. But he just couldn't lose the landline. Despite all the modern amenities, the app-adjusted lighting and centrally cooled air, he remained attached to his relics. His landline, his cable box, his TV remotes, his recliner, his VHS player, his home-delivered newspaper, and his basement office. He also retained his desk calendar from 1991, his roller chair and his monkey paw back scratcher, although he did manage to ditch the sheet of stamped plastic specifically designed to facilitate the easy rolling of roller chairs in challenging terrain. Jerry was calling him. "How's tricks, my boy?" They fell to talking about a legal dilemma facing the company. An account creator out of Norway, having chipped in the equivalent of $200 US toward the infinity ring his girlfriend coveted, but which the young man alone could not afford, had recently had his heart broken by the girl and withdrawn his money, minus the penalty forfeited to chipping in, per the user agreement, for withdrawal from an, quote, unconsummated campaign. Now he was bringing legal action against the website with help from other chippers similarly penalized, and of course a team of Delaware lawyers. Charlie was apprised of all this and then weighed his options. "Let's give him his money back," he said. "Too late for that, Pop. They've filed a class action. So let's settle. And let the ambulance chasers win? What if we..." "Look, Pop, these guys don't have a leg to stand on," Jerry argued. "We're up front on the home page about fees and penalties. They have to agree to them again when they establish an account, and then every time they chip in. We can't just let them wreak havoc with the revenue model. We run that model. We depend on it. We profit from it. Should we do away with the model and run a charity instead?" "Okay," he said. "Put Einsohn on it." "Einsohn," Jerry said with a verbal roll of the eyes. But Charlie, who always knew when he was in the wrong, had been in the wrong about Einsohn. He only had to come out from under his debts, real and psychic, to admit it freely. The failure of his dear TTAA was one of poor planning and misallocated resources, not bad legal advice from the man out in Aurora. Had he simply not rented quite so many billboards, had he not ordered so many brochures, TTAA might not have failed. When it did fail, he needed someone to blame. Charlie now had a little insight into the legal profession. You might hire a lawyer, but you always fire a fall guy. Now, in 2016, 8 years older than he had any right to be, he would not blame Einsohn.
We have our pick of litigators from here to Silicon Valley, and you like this two-bit Einzone. I just don't get it. I gave Einzone a hard time 100 years ago for something that wasn't really his fault. I feel bad about that now, and I'd like to make up for it. Do you see? Give it to Einzone. Fine, he said. I'll give it to Einzone. And while we're at it, we've had other news. Facebook improved their offer.
He buried the lead, Jerry.
It's a better offer, he said. As in a much better offer. There was a long pause. We're talking a lot of damn money here, pup. It was such a curious thing, life. You simply couldn't predict it. The anti-corporate proselytizer was now working night and day for a for-profit enterprise, while the born adherent and lifelong striver had his scruples and doubts, as anyone will after making a break with a cult. For damn near a lifetime, Charlie Barnes had proved easy enough to brainwash. His elders and betters had only to repeat the phrase self-made man enough times to convince him there was no other way to make it in America, and anything short of that was weak commie failure. The self-made man got no assists, enjoyed no pre-existing network or infrastructure, took comfort in no collective, and owed no one an apology for his trampling and rough treatment. He simply sprang from the Godhead with his native genius and oaken strength and immediately set forth clearing, herding, stamping, exploiting, acquiring, colonizing, and finally buying his way into office. These elders of his, these peddlers of fantasy, with their dear dead narratives, pretty much guaranteed that until the day he got sick, he would not come into possession of a single original thought. It was all propaganda and petrified national myth. When sickness swept that away, when it left him vulnerable, when it freed up his mind to think for itself, an idea of his own came dimly into view. But he thought, that can't be right, can it? It was so obvious an idea, so modest in scope, essentially so dull, that he failed to see how it might be revolutionary. No, not chipping in. That idea came to him much earlier. And, as the article in Kiplinger's pointed out, predated Kickstarter's April 2009 launch by 1 month, while doing something distinct from it, namely, combining crowdfunding with gift registry. It had made him a small fortune. It was no sweat off his back. No, he had in mind something else entirely. His calling, that tailor-made thing that was less revelation than resignation to who he was and always must be. Charles A. Barnes of Danville, Illinois. The man that was Steady Boy. His goddamn calling was a pain in the ass and cost him what remained of his strength. But that was the nature of bargains. If you're looking for a few good years, sell your soul to the devil. Want to save your soul? Give your life away. Answer's still no, Jerry, he said, after giving it some thought. I like us the way we are. Small and scrappy. Unexploited. He said. It was an idea I had once. Now it employs a few people. Shouldn't that be enough? Don't you at least want to hear the number? His son, meanwhile. What a trajectory Jerry had had. The one-time commuter and company man turned Noam Chomsky acolyte, now contrite, and recommitted to the bottom line. After coming to live with Charlie, he did what he could to re-enter the workforce. He applied day and night. He expressed a willingness to relocate. He would have happily been lowballed. But his timing was bad. The economy had tanked. And he'd been out of the workforce by then for 3 full years. prospective employers looked askance at him. His resume had this glaring hole in it, and he got very few callbacks. On the rare occasion he was invited to interview, he would bring up Krishnamurti, or go on a mini-rant about neoliberalism and blow it. Or HR would take a quick look at his Facebook posts. Or he would tell the truth about why he spent 3 years out of the workforce. Three became four, then four became five, six, and seven. He lived at 105 Rust Road for 4 years. This is why I would say Jerry was a lucky man. He needed Charlie at 15, and he needed him at 50, and both times Charlie was there for him. You can't buy that in life. You have to luck into it. Then Chippin' In took off. Charlie was busy doing his own thing by that point and sought Jerry's help. Jerry seemed to slot right back into the filing cabinet and office chair. He had tried resistance, renunciation, life on the margins. Working just felt better. There was more to the morning. But for him to realize this, the gatekeepers, headhunters, HR reps, had to bar entry first. You want out of corporate America, pal? Fine, but be forewarned. We are a self-selecting group. You will not be welcomed back. And sure enough, they proceeded to deprive him not only of the paychecks and benefits necessary to survival, but also of capitalism's foremost appeal, membership. When Jerry rejected it, no big deal. When it rejected Jerry, it continued to reject Jerry indefinitely. The things he took for granted, like usefulness, personal fulfillment, collective purpose, went away. And he wondered briefly, why not put a bullet in my head? I think Chippin' In saved Jerry Barnes's life. He was relieved to have been rescued, to be partaking of company pride again, to be part of a team, in the human fold once more. Now he ran a staff of 12 in a South Loop office. Sure, Jerry. For shits and giggles, give me the number. Jerry told his father the number. Charlie went quiet. That is a large sum, the old man admitted. Does it change your mind? There was a long pause. It does not, he said. Look, Jerry, do what you want with the company after I'm dead and gone, but truth of the matter is, son, I don't like Facebook. I sure as hell don't like what it's done to newspapers. I love my newspaper, Jerry. I still have it delivered. I read it under the pergola with a glass of wine. I know you do, Pop. And I think Facebook would like to do away with my newspaper and every other newspaper and bank the subscription fees. That can't be good for anybody. And who knows? They just might succeed. Well, in that case, they can't have my brainchild, too. Screw those wolves in sheep's clothing, Jerry. They're not half the messiahs they think they are. Matter of fact, they might just be the devil itself. I didn't know you felt so strongly. They'll run their metrics, they'll squeeze the margins, they'll monetize everything. Fuck it. No way. All right. All right. I hear you. Screw venture capital, son, and screw big tech, too. When I'm dead, do what you want, but not until then. Not for many years, then, Pop, Jerry said. 51. Let us return briefly to 2009, just prior to Charlie's first round of chemo. He had a consultation with his oncologist, a Dr. Baruch Clement of First Baptist. Barbara was present, of course, and didn't hesitate to make her opinion known. She did not like the anti-cancer agent gemcitabine on its own. She urged Clement to be more aggressive.
Of course, there was always a risk that a multi-agent therapy would increase Charlie's toxicity and bring on neutropenia, a dangerously low count of a type of white blood cell crucial to fighting infection. But consistent blood tests revealed that he had near-normal bilirubin levels and a good performance status overall. It was her belief that either a GTX regimen or a gemcitabine with a platinum and a daily oral dose of Tarceva would give him the best chance of long-term survival. As she spoke, an all-consuming concern Charlie had for himself was momentarily overtaken by the growing awe he felt for his wife. "How do you know all this stuff?" he asked. Clement, too, looked impressed.
"No kidding," he said. "When you're done helping this guy out, how about you come and be my nurse?"
As they resumed their technical talk, Charlie's awe turned back to dread. Every option they debated sounded, in the end, totally fucking terrible. Then he arrived at the chemo center, took a seat in one of the many luxurious leather recliners positioned around the room, and had the poisons they discussed that day pumped into him, and wondered if they hadn't been conspiring to murder him. He promptly hated life. Brain fog, of the kind his mother complained about, moved in and parked. Other lugubrious, agonizing, morning-after side effects, which he dubbed his chemover, hit him methodically on the second day. His mouth broke out in open sores. By some miracle of misfortune, he managed both to lose his hair and retain just enough of it to go around with bedhead for 3 months running. A fanatic comber in a past life, he would no longer even glance in a mirror. As one does with mudslides, avalanches, and other breaches, I looked on in horror from a distance as his vanity gave way, then his hygiene, then deodorizing of any kind. He camped out on his recliner, where he made it known he would just as soon die, and where I believed him to be fast asleep when, on a Tuesday morning, he entered the living room from the direction of the dining room, an irregular entry point in that house, and stood facing me just to the left of the muted television. I had been half asleep, sprawled out on the sofa per usual.
"What is it, Chuck?" I asked, sitting up.
"I've had enough."
"Of?"
"Chemo," he said, and he raised a little pistol to his temple. I recall thinking, Lordy, that's one small gun, a saloon gal's gun, and unlikely to do anyone any harm. Sure enough, when he pulled the trigger, there was only the sudden sizzling zap of the television turning off, according to some metaphysical connection between the two. As shocked as anyone, he turned to behold the blank screen. His shoulders began to roll with sitcom laughter. Mine too, or at least one of them did, and I opened my eyes and found Charlie standing over me, eager to wake me from my dream of suicide and sitcoms. It was not Tuesday morning, but a late Friday afternoon.
"Look at this, Jake!"
I sat up in the front room in the house on Rust Road. In a daze, I accepted the letter being thrust at me. It took a moment, but eventually I understood it was a transcript from Michigan State University. "I thought you graduated from Michigan State," I said, running my eyes over so many incompletes.
"That's just a story I tell," he said. "But don't you see? That's the point. This is it, Jake," he cried. "This is my calling."
He had, by then, wisely dismissed the idea of becoming a divorce mediator or one of the other pie-in-the-sky professions he had landed on in conversation with Barbara. They were fine, as individual choices go, but his general approach fit an old pattern. Steady boy dreaming big again without reason, going for broke when he had no right to. He'd spent a lifetime lurching from thing to thing. this time had to be different. Returning to school sounded right, because it would require hard work and real sacrifice, with no guarantee of personal gain, as Jerry and the Gita claimed a true calling demanded. He had to tell Barbara the good news and raced upstairs for his car keys. He clomped down a minute later, wearing the red corduroys by Brunello Cucinelli that he bought for a song on the day of his diagnosis. He'd been saving them for the right occasion. "Hey, Chuck," I said, "there's something I need to tell you." He was removing a hat from the hat rack when he turned to me. "You asked me to find your teeth after surgery," I said, "but I couldn't do that."
"Why not?"
"Barbara had them. She's the one who put them back in your mouth."
"That wasn't you?"
"That was Barbara," I said.
"Barbara had them?"
I nodded. There was a long pause, during which he stood very still, as if to steady himself amid such disorienting and devastating news. It did not make him happy. I wish he could have owned it. I mean, really owned it. Imagine him removing those fuckers on a whim for the comic shock, or harmonizing with the hare lips, wall eyes, and stutters in a collective little song of sorrow. He could have done anything had he just owned it. I wanted that, not for my sake, to confirm that he knew he was loved, accepted, embraced, but for his own, to know that he loved himself. There was the difference in Shakespeare's formula of man and man. Had Charlie the power to take out his teeth in a crowd, the power the crowd had over him would have vanished. The success that eluded him was always within his grasp, but impossible to seize because of his stupid pride, the only justification for which was its own overcoming. But wasn't I one to talk? I could hardly bear to imagine whom I came from, or why I was left to die in the Fair Oaks housing project. My mother's taste for drink, my stupid birth defect. And while I attack Jerry's and Marcy's monumental scorn for their humble roots, regarding them as ingrates for wanting to put a little distance between them and Steady Boy, I go around pretending we share a common inheritance, when nothing could be further from the truth. I have seen my birth certificate. The stranger named as my father means nothing to me. I'd sooner call Dickie Dickerdick Dad. I, too, wanted to be a self-made man in my own humble way, and was more than happy, as Charlie had been, to brush off reality and embrace the dream. My foster family, the Barnes clan, squanderers of riches they took for granted, didn't need me. They probably didn't want me. They might not have even liked me. Charlie Barnes was always bowing out because he didn't care to abide by the rules. I didn't care for the rules either, but not because I wanted to bow out. I wanted to be let in. "Thanks for letting me know," he said. "You're a good man, Jake Barnes." Then he was off, opening the garage door, firing up the engine, and stealing away to First Baptist in a broken-down sob. Or was it the Porsche that, these many months later, he still hadn't returned to Rabineau? Pesky little Porsche. Perhaps it was a third car altogether. "It sounds perfect to me," Barbara declared the minute he announced his intentions in the cafeteria of First Baptist. "It won't be easy, young lady. Nothing worthwhile ever is." "We'll be pinched. We're pinched now. It'll only get worse." "You have to do it, Charlie. It's more important than money or anything else. I'll pick up a shift here and there. We'll take out a few credit cards. We'll get by. And then you'll have your degree. Do you know what you'd like to study?" He had learned his lesson. Do not delve. He had done so in the past, and it hadn't worked out. But move in the direction of love,
and life always gets harder. He was married to Barbara, this time, not Charlie Prophet. It was Barbara Ledeux who saw the big picture. He tapped his teeth. "You know about these," he said. She nodded. "And you don't mind?" "Of course I don't mind." There was a long pause. "You love me." "Of course I love you, young man." "I don't know why." "You don't?" "I don't." She reached across the table and touched the brim of his touring cap. "Because you can wear a hat," she said. He had identified his calling in life, had secured his wife's support, and departed the hospital in good spirits. Those spirits began to dim, even before he reached the highway. If completing the nightly reading had been hard as a young man of 27, how much more difficult would it be at 69? Recently cut open, fried with chemo, and prone to fall asleep before the rigor of friends? Then there were more practical considerations. Was there a college that would take him? A financial institution that would loan him money? By the time he arrived home, he was running a fever of 102. In an event like that, the instructions were clear. Any fever in an immune system compromised by chemo could be fatal. He had to return to First Baptist immediately. He spent the next 48 hours under observation by Dr. Clement, who did not hesitate to run a battery of tests. While in the hospital, Chuck begged me to check out a bunch of books from the library so that he could begin his course of study. "Ah," I thought, "so this silly occupation of mine isn't so silly after all. Who else could curate for him a college reading list?" I did so happily. He didn't think he had another moment to spare. I saw a real panic in his eyes, the dread that awaits anyone who feels the clock running down on him. A day later, he hadn't touched a single one of my selection of classics. I walked in on him still having a go with the Gita, the book on his chest, the man fast asleep. "Hey, Chuck," I whispered. "Hey, Dad." He sat up slowly and registered having fallen asleep.
"Oh, God damn it," he said.
"Who am I fooling? I'm no goddamn student." "Go easy on yourself," I said. "You're sick." "No, it's more than that, Jake. I hate to read. What's the point of going back to school if I can't read anything but the goddamn newspaper?" "Don't give up so easily, Chuck." "No, it's not in me, son. God damn it, it's just not in me." He was upset with himself, demoralized. He believed he had found it. And it did sound pretty good, at least on paper. But it was true, he couldn't stay awake. He gazed out the window in complete despair. "Hold on," he said. "What is it?" He got out of bed, went to the window. Then he did something more curious still. He turned in his hospital gown, sat directly on the floor, and crossed his legs. "What are you doing down there, Chuck? Are you in a yoga pose?" "Jake," he said. He gazed off. "It can't be about me this time."
"What's it got to be about?" I asked.
He loved her. No one could explain why. She lionized him all out of proportion. She understood that failure did not define him or curb his need to be loved. She called him her silver fox. She found it heroic that he railed against the likes of Jimmy Kane and started a business that specialized in retirees. And when we looked up, she was standing in the doorway, a honeypot in scrubs and buzz cut.
"What on earth are you doing sitting on the floor?" she asked him.
"And why are the two of you looking at me like that?"
52.
Dr. Clement studied the numbers and scratched his head. Charlie's heme-8 was fine, as was his CBC. There had been no discernible drop in platelet count. He discharged him with a dose of Tylenol, which resolved the fever, only to have it return a week later right on time and high as ever. The doctor threw up his hands. "There is one possible answer," Barbara suggested.
"Please," the doctor said. "Enlighten me."
"Someone's forgetting his prednisone."
Sure enough, the order for infused steroids to be administered simultaneously with the anti-cancer cocktail had gone missing 2 weeks running at the chemo center, an unaccountable clerical error. And it might have remained a mystery had it not been for a passing observation from the nurse at First Baptist.
"How did you know about that prednisone business?" he asked her on the drive home.
"Lucky guess."
"But how do you know enough to guess?"
She was an ER nurse, the nurse at First Baptist, not a doctor. Her degree, from a dinky DuPage college no longer in existence, dated back 30 years to 1981. In her graduation photo, she wore starched whites and a nurse's cap, as if mentored by Florence Nightingale.
"I am a nurse, Charlie."
"And most nurses," he said. "Would they have made that same guess?" She just shrugged. She had the next 3 days off work. She drove everyone from the living room, silenced the television, started the laundry, and went through the mail, restoring the house to her liking. I returned to my rental, Jerry retreated to Troy's room, and Charlie battled malaise in the master bedroom. By the late afternoon, however, he was feeling well enough to accompany her to the bookstore, and on their way home, to no one's surprise more than his own, he suggested they stop for a pizza.
"Are you sure you're up for it?" she asked.
"Honey," he said, "what's it all been for if I can't do a slice of pizza?" He would pay for it the next day, but it was also more fun than a couple of hours at a pizza joint in the suburbs had any right to be. He had a beer, then a glass of wine. She shared a few of the idiot things that had brought people into the ER of late, like the woman who sewed 2 fingers together with a hacked sewing machine, and the teenager who swallowed a bouncy ball on a dare. He had done some thinking by then. Her ability to interpret those numbers on that little white napkin, her opinion on gemcitabine with a platinum, his near-normal bilirubin levels, words right out of her own mouth, solving the mystery of his fever. His wife knew more about the particulars of cancer than he ever would have suspected had he simply dropped dead of a heart attack. After the waitress brought them dessert, he said, "Can we go back to the prednisone thing?"
"What about it?"
"You knew more than the doctor." "How did you know more than the doctor?"
"I read up."
"You read up?" "Barbara, I don't even know what prednisone is, even now."
"Honey," he said, "you could be a doctor." She quickly dismissed that.
"No interest?"
There was a long pause. "I wanted to be a doctor, but then I met Bob," her first husband, a plumber in Gurnee. "We had the kids, and, well, like we had the time or money to send me to medical school."
"And what about now?"
She cocked her head across the remains of their creme brulee. "Like we have the time or money to send me to medical school."
On her final day off, he walked into the kitchen after a rough night's sleep to find her in reading glasses, tackling the book she'd purchased only a few days earlier. She was responsible for holding down a full-time job, for keeping his spirits up and his doctors on their toes, and for running the house and paying the bills while he was out of commission. How did she also have time to read a book? Called The Emperor of All Maladies, it was subtitled A Biography of Cancer, and it was one big mother.
yet she was practically done with it. She turned another page. Hovering over her, he tapped the thick mound of pages already consumed.
"Astonishing," he said.
"What's astonishing?"
"You've had that book 2 days, and you're almost done with it."
"It's a quick read."
"For you, maybe. For me, a climb up the Himalayas."
She smiled before resuming.
"Young lady,"
she looked up again. He had taken the seat across the table from her.
"It ain't gonna happen, my dear. My little dream of returning to school to get my degree."
"Why not?" He told her of how little appetite he had for reading anything but the newspaper.
"But you know who does like to read?"
He pointed across the table at her.
"I want you to go back to school for me."
"But I have my degree, young man."
"I mean medical school," he said. At these words, she carefully closed up her book.
She moved it aside and took off her reading glasses and folded them and brought her hands together. She made herself small, he thought, as if trying to disappear, and did not respond.
"You don't like the idea?"
"I'm 49 years old," she said.
"People go back to school at that age."
"We can't afford medical school."
"We'll take out a few credit cards," he said, quoting her. "You are prepared to do it for me? Why not for yourself?"
"That's not what I do, Charlie."
"Not what you do?"
"I don't..."
"What?"
"Dare," she said. "Dream."
He nodded. "Okay," he said. "But I do. Look, is it a stretch? Probably. But is it completely irrational?"
"Probably," she said.
"Fine. Then tell me the great advantage to being fucking rational."
"Rational is the fact of death.
Rational is chemo in response to cancer. Rational is sleeping all day long in the hopes of surviving until I've slept my life away. I am sick and tired of being rational. I want to dream again, Barbara. But I'm old, and I've failed too often. But you, young lady, you..."
He couldn't finish the thought. A lifetime ago, when he was married to a local beauty dedicated to a life of social work, he took a job with Waukegan Title. His pride prevented him from admitting to Charlie Prophet his reason for doing so. She pursued a calling in life, as he knew he never would. He lacked her passion, her single-mindedness. The least he could do, he believed, was pull in a few extra bucks every month to better support her. God knows he wasn't doing it because Waukegan Title was his dream job. It lacked glamour. No one would adore him for it. He did it for her. But then he couldn't disclose that because he was the man, and the man was supposed to have the calling. He had no such compunction anymore. He would have happily worked for Archie Baker. He would have shined Archie's shoes and washed Archie's car, then turned to every man in the joint to announce that he was doing it all for a woman, the amateur oncologist moonlighting as his wife.
"I want you to take the entrance exam for medical school," he said. "Will you do that for me?"
"How can we afford medical school, Charlie?"
"Well, I don't know," he admitted. "That I don't know."
"What would be the point?"
"Hope," he said. "And change. Something other than this goddamn dreary chemo and the constant talk of cancer."
"I don't know," she said.
He was the live wire, the pursuer of dreams. She was the steady, inscrutable one. But she could also read 1,000 words a minute. She had a photographic memory for symptoms and procedures. She had learned Spanish simply by overhearing exchanges in the ER,
and she required no more than 4 hours of sleep at night. What did she have to lose? He asked her. He urged her. What's one exam? They returned to the bookstore for an exam prep book. Then she began waking before dawn to put in a few hours of study before her shift at the hospital, and when she came home at night, she put in a few more hours. She took the exam in June. She was at work when the results arrived in the mail. She forbade Charlie from opening them. She alone would know how badly she had failed. Then she would quietly deposit that letter in the garbage and put the whole mortifying episode behind her. And, in fact, when she came home that night and tore open the letter and read the test results, she retreated from the room without a single word. But she didn't toss the letter. She left it on the table. When he picked it up and made sense of it, he climbed the stairs and found her lying on the bed in the dark, still dressed in her scrubs and staring up at the ceiling. He lay next to her without a word, wanting her to say whatever was on her mind, though his heart was full and beating fast. "Why did you make me take that test?" she asked him. "Why, Charlie?" "Honey," he said. "How could we afford it?" "I don't know yet," he said. At last she turned to him. "I could do this," she said, going on record for the first time, because committing to anything before that letter arrived with its good news would have left her vulnerable, beholden to a pipe dream she would have left for dead had Charlie not drawn it out of her. "Yes," he said, "I believe you could." 53. In a private moment of self-reflection, a man confronts the farce that he is. All his worst instincts, habits of mind, predictable appetites, and easily parodied past actions crystallize in that moment into a punchline that prevails above all his refinements and respectability. He is a human exaggeration, if not to his associates or loved ones, then to himself. Then the moment passes. He ceases looking at himself in the mirror, turns on the tap, and splashes water on his face. He returns to flesh and blood, to power incarnate, to possibility. He washes his hands of the past and leaves that temporary station where he was briefly nothing but a joke, and walks out again into the future. He came out of the bathroom at the Starbucks on Golf Road where he and I had gone for an afternoon latte. He wanted to talk about what he might do, now that he was almost finished with chemo, to raise money so that Barbara could reduce her hours at the hospital and return to school. We sat at a table in the window, puzzling it out. His money management fees were way down. Chipping in hadn't taken off. He didn't have many options. He started telling me about the Lamplighter Inn. The Lamplighter was the Danville Supper Club and entertainment venue located on Perrysville Road, where in 1961 he took a job washing dishes and back with the firm belief that within 2 years I'd be the MC. The MC? The crooner on stage, you know, in the bow tie, the one cracking wise. I got an image of the Lamplighter Inn. Round tables and cocktails, women in sequins, and men in white dinner jackets, all the biggest shakes in a small town. From dishwasher to Dean Martin, I said. That's right, Jake. Dean Martin. Why not? All they had to do was discover me. And did they? What they discovered was how little interest I had in actually washing dishes, so they fired me. We walked out of the Starbucks and into a bright summer's day. He was no closer to knowing what he was going to do. He only knew what he couldn't do. He couldn't dream big again, not even one last time, and go off half-cocked. He couldn't start something with the goal of franchising it. He couldn't come up with the tagline, print the brochure, hire an engineer, partner with the banks, or write letters to captains of industry pleading for capital funding. His days of expanding out to the coasts were over. When we got inside the car, he looked tired and old. I put the car in reverse. He reached out and touched my hand. "Pull back in," he said. I did as he asked. He unbuckled and said he'd be right back. He returned to the car a minute later with a job application. The manager of the Starbucks said that while they weren't hiring at the moment, she would keep his application on file and contact him if a position opened up. As we left the Starbucks, he asked me to drive him to Staples, the office supply store, where he purchased a file folder and a box of pens. Before departing, he asked the kid at the register for a job application. In the car again, he placed both the Starbucks application and the one for Staples in the file folder. Then he asked me to drive him to the Sears in the Woodfield Mall. There, he asked to speak to a manager. He told that woman his name and asked if they were hiring. He asked the same of managers at Nordstrom, JCPenney, Macy's, and Things Remembered. We left the Woodfield Mall and drove down Gulf Road, then East Higgins, then Meacham and Algonquin, stopping at places like the Hyatt, the Dollar Tree, and the Hobby Lobby, collecting applications at each of them. Then we returned to the car, and he carefully placed them in the file folder, filling them out later that night at the kitchen table in the house on Rust Road. He had an exacting hand, went slowly, and did not permit a mistake.
"What the hell's going on?"
Jerry asked one morning when we met in the kitchen as the old man showered upstairs.
"What do you mean?"
"He's filling out applications for entry-level jobs," he said.
"What's that all about?"
"He's feeling better," I said.
"Feeling better? He's out of his mind again."
It was hard for Jerry to wrap his head around it. There were certain points of pride from which he never imagined Steady Boy might retreat. Since he first put on a suit and tie in 1963, it was suit and tie work for Charlie Barnes from then on, or work be damned. He traded in hourly pay for the yearly salary and would never go back. It would be shameful to go back. So what the hell was he doing applying at the Home Depot? Charlie paid a visit to European Motors that day. His appearance had changed considerably for the worse in 6 months' time. The surgery and chemo had bent him and hollowed out his eyes, so much so that Rabineau, the old mechanic, didn't recognize him at first. When at last it clicked, he was confused. For 15 years, Charlie Barnes had arrived in his waiting room in jacket and tie, or button-down and slacks, or jazzy sweater and pressed trousers, the image of the American businessman. Now he was asking to sweep the garage floor? "Sweep, scrub, be a gopher, whatever you need. I don't know too much about tools, though." Rabineau shook his head. Times were hard, and he wasn't hiring. Then something occurred to him, and he shot up an inky digit.
"Can you balance the books?"
Steady Boy had long feared such an unglamorous fate. Not only would he fail to make a killing, but some fall from grace or bankruptcy would also send him back to the days of just scraping by on some job site or sales floor, and premonitions of the boredom, together with the bad pay, would turn him electric with dread. But then he saw how different it might be if he returned to the earliest days of his professional life of his own accord, yet on behalf of someone other than himself. With that simple shift in perspective, he had more equanimity busting his hump than he ever had as a younger man. It was not all that different from the moment he realized that he didn't mind mowing the lawn, so long as it was on behalf of Charlie Profit. I remember thinking how unlikely it was that 2 weeks after his final chemo infusion, 2 short weeks
after all that television, a mere 2 weeks after he was unable to make a sandwich for himself, he was waking at 7 to shower and leaving the house by 8. Well, why not? The Whipple was a success. Chemo was over. His counts were holding steady. So while Barbara was applying to the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University, he was applying to Costco. While she applied to the University of Chicago, he submitted an application to Bed Bath & Beyond. And while he was speaking to a manager at Luna Flooring Gallery on Gulf Road about an opening in their sales department, she was applying to the Stritch School of Medicine at Loyola University. He worked at the Walmart on Roselle Road for a total of 5 days. He worked at the Target down the street for no more than 2 months. He stepped out of a Lowe's vest and into a Best Buy polo and exchanged a Panera visor for a Wendy's cap. He treated these franchises and chain outfits in the same fashion as they tended to treat people like him, as something to chew up and spit out. He leaped from $8.15 an hour at PetSmart to $9.65 an hour at Petco after working at PetSmart a single day. It was practically a full-time job just seizing opportunities like this one, dropping off his resume with a dose of charm, and asking for more money everywhere he went, from Applebee's to GameStop and from GameStop to Zales. The money this patchwork of gigs and hustles provided, until chipping in took off, was just enough to pay the bills and stay current on the mortgage while also allowing Barbara to pull back at First Baptist. He took his half hour at noon and his 15 at 2:30, clocking in and out. There were many shifts when he did not go that extra mile, but merely offered up a warm body so that no one took off with the store. It was here his particular genius resided, for if anyone knew how to cut corners, fly under the radar, and play fast and loose with the demands of a dress code, it was that original son of Danville, Steady Boy Barnes. Working for the man was my father's calling. Throughout this final career swerve, he never stopped working for Rabineau. He balanced the man's books, did his taxes, and made sense of his inventory, all while paying attention to the mechanics at their work. When he identified his first master cylinder problem in a 1982 Porsche 911, the pleasure he carried home to Barbara was all the evidence she needed to know that he wasn't fibbing. He was out there busting his hump for his own sake, too. It brought him the greatest satisfaction to repair a pre-existing thing. Some years later, Rabineau attended the housewarming party on Harmony Drive. The old mechanic didn't look well that day. There was no early detection in his case. No surgical option, no time to set things right. He just died. By then, Charlie had chipping in money. He bought European Motors and the Porsche that came with it. 54. I flew down one last time to Deer Park to try my best to convince Marcy that her father, 1 year after his initial diagnosis, had turned his life around and deserved her forgiveness. I had little hope of getting very far. She had told me repeatedly to butt out and fuck off, blocked my calls and texts, and refused to see me outright on 2 earlier occasions when, like some tool on a business trip, I'd flown in and out again without accomplishing much. This final time, I resorted to writing her a letter, which I made sure to post a week before my arrival, informing her of the exact day I would be in town and when she could expect me to be at the sports bar where she and I had previously met. The last thing I anticipated was to find her waiting for me in the lobby of the hotel where I tended to stay whenever in the park, or to watch her rise out of a rose-patterned wingback chair and come forward in order to put her arms around me. I dropped my bag and put my arm around her. When our embrace ended,
She looked at me with her big hazel eyes full of stardust and thanked me for all I'd done for Daddy over the course of the year, the sacrifices I'd made, the love and loyalty I'd shown. "Of course," I said. "Thank you for never giving up on us, Jake. We can be a pretty crazy bunch, I know." I was eager to sit down with her to explain all the many changes underway at the house on Rust Road, but I didn't manage to say much before she cut me off. "Is Daddy really working at Best Buy?" "And at the Menards in Hanover Park, but that's only part-time. If he gets between 48 and 52 hours of work every week between the two, then he thinks he should be able to cover the monthly expenses."
"And why is he doing this?"
"So that Barbara can go back to school and get her medical degree."
"He's doing it for Barbara?"
"I know you don't like her, Marcy, and it's true, she's strange. A damn strange woman. But you should have seen her nurse him back to health when he got sick. I promised him I'd tell each of you how devoted she was to his care and how tenderly she treated him. Honestly, I think we've sold her short." There was a long pause.
"Best Buy?"
she said.
"Jake, this isn't some kind of joke, is it?"
"You just have to see it with your own two eyes, Marcy. What do you say? I know he'd love to see you." I couldn't believe it. She was actually giving it some thought. "When do you leave?" she asked. I worried that between parting that night and our plans to meet up again 12 hours later, changeable Marcy would reconsider her options, or suffer a manic episode, or recall her past delight at toying with me and simply not show. But there she was in the lobby the next morning at the appointed hour, ready to depart for Houston and O'Hare. It was curious to me how the chief complaint against Marcy was that she was constantly changing, while the chief complaint against Charlie was that he never changed. He was steady boy through and through. We wanted opposite things from the two of them. Marcy to iron out her inconsistencies, Charlie to surprise us with his sudden rectitude and dependability. Well, live long enough, it seems, and you might just get your wish at least once. It isn't typical to land at O'Hare and drive straight to a big-box retailer, but that's what Marcy and I did that morning. We walked in through the automated doors and looked around for him under the industrial rafters, and when at last we spotted him in the distance under the deathly light, I witnessed her shock at the physical changes in him. That man, so memorable for his mutton chops and curls, his strong push-off before a hookshot and his big bear hugs, and for the alacrity with which he fell to all fours to give an instep a squeeze, was for Marcy, on that day, the same man I saw emerge from the Whipple. It did more to move her than all my trips to Deer Park. I thought back on my years of envy, the dumb luck that gave her a dad and me a mere surrogate, always tenuous. And I realized that, in fact, it was tenuous for everyone, always, the fortunate no less than the fostered, because in time, the world makes orphans of us all. "Look who it is," he said, as the tears hung in his eyes and the man opened his arms.
"Oh, Daddy,"
she said, and they embraced among the electronics.
"My dear heart, my dear, dear heart. I'm sorry I didn't come sooner, Daddy. You have made me so very, very happy."
And that was that. He took his 30-minute break next door at the Starbucks, where he initiated a conversation with his daughter that continues to this day, as he approaches 81. They didn't touch upon what happened when her mother made Dickie into Dad, or what transpired the summer of her 8th-grade year. All that would come later. They talked instead about the cancer and the chemo, the enzymes he was forced to take with every meal, the diabetes he had to manage and the kidney stones he had to watch. And then he hung up, I mean, returned to work. At the Best Buy, where he sold televisions for $8.85 an hour. The following morning, Barbara was sitting at the kitchen table in the house on Rust Road in her reading glasses and scrubs, poring over a textbook, while next to her, out of those dumb cutoffs at last, and in khakis and a button-down, Jerry sat looking silently at job leads on an ancient laptop. The old man was there, too, reading the sports page and eating a grapefruit and two boiled eggs. He looked up from his paper when I entered and asked if I'd like some coffee. He poured me a cup. Jerry passed me the milk. I asked for a section of the paper. A companionable silence held for another 10 minutes or so, until Marcy rang the doorbell and everyone greeted her, including Barbara. It was possible to imagine that with a medical degree in hand one day, Charlie's brittle bride wouldn't be quite so insecure, but would accept us, or them at least, as unconditional objects of a father's love, and decent enough people to have around. In the meantime, before she arrived, we ate, sipped, read, the four members of a very odd little family enjoying a bit of calm before the day's storm. I had seen a little world go kablooey in Danville, another do the same in Key West, and a third in Downers Grove. And it seemed likely to happen a fourth time in the house on Rust Road. But it didn't. Charlie lucked out. Barbara returned to school. Jerry fell and was caught. Marcy came around. It was time for me to fly back to Rome. Barbara stopped me on my way out to my rental car on my return to the airport.
"You have been a great help to us, Jake," she said. "I didn't understand why you were here at first."
"I wanted to be here," I said.
"Right, but why?" "Well, now I know. You love that man. You love him like I do. He couldn't have done this, we couldn't have done it, without you. You have a big heart, Jake, and you are a good son, and I love you like my own."
She'd never said so many words aloud to me ever, yet her eyes never wavered from mine. She pulled me in for a hug, and a year's worth of emptiness and terror and hope got jarred loose in me. And for what felt like a full day outside the house on Rust Road, I cried like a baby in that woman's arms. 55. He was long retired from the Best Buy and the other penny-ante gigs when, in 2016, he read the news about Wells Fargo and made one final attempt to get in touch with Larry Stovall. Then he spoke with Jerry about the future of Chippin' In. And then, believe it or not, he moved a little money around on behalf of those clients he retained from his days as CEO and sole employee of TTAA, to which he remained sentimentally attached. Then, with the newspaper in one hand and the cordless in the other, he climbed the basement stairs and collapsed in his recliner with every intention of taking a nap. In a few short weeks, he would turn another year older, on election day, in point of fact. He had had 8 years of hope and change. Never had he had more hope. And in no other 8-year period of time had he undergone such change. You believe in change, don't you? That a man need not be mired hopelessly in himself, confined to his appetites and checked by his limits, bound for the grave much as he came into the world, making promises he would never keep, and fooling himself every step of the way? When he woke from his nap an hour later, it was not where he remembered having nodded off, on the recliner in the front room, but under the ivy-laced pergola in his backyard. Sunlight played over his outstretched legs. He was preparing to return inside when the cordless began to ring. It was Dr. Clement, his oncologist at First Baptist.
"How about that wife of yours?" Clement remarked right out of the gate. Our finest nurse, and now our newest resident.
She's so pleased to be back at First Baptist, Charlie assured him.
We're lucky to have her. How she made it through medical school in such record time, I will never know.
Now, she's a quick study, he said. But I don't imagine you're calling just to sing Barbara's praises.
That's true, the doctor said. Charlie, your test results have come in.
He had foregone regular testing in recent years, finding the wait for numbers every 3 months a morbid drum roll and a major fetter on his freedom, much as the full-time job had been before he found his calling. But in recent weeks, there was no denying the persistence of his new cough, or his need some days for supplemental oxygen. He had a little tank for that purpose, which he rolled around on two wheels, but which didn't always fill his lungs as he might have wished, and which, on those days, he referred to as his moxygen tank, because it seemed to do little more than mock him.
I'm afraid it's back, Charlie. It's in your liver, lungs, and spine. He cleared his throat.
I see, he said. And my prognosis?
I'll be honest, Charlie, it's not great. But there are some experimental treatments out there and a clinical trial or two that might be worth looking into. It's a bit of a long shot, but hey, you've done an extraordinary job of beating the odds thus far. What do you say we make an appointment for sometime next week, and you and Barbara and I sit down and discuss your options?
That sounds fine, he said.
After making that appointment with the nurse, he got off the phone and sat very still a while, lost in thought. He knew he should call Barbara, and his children too, and break the news. He had been so eager to do just that 8 years earlier, before the doctor had even confirmed a diagnosis. How pathetic he was back then, he thought now, longing for an incontrovertible source of pity, like pancreatic cancer, to share with others so that they might think upon him as tenderly as he did himself. He deferred making those calls, set the cordless down, and went inside. He returned to the pergola with an old book his son had given him. He took up the chair again and resumed where he had left off in the book some years earlier. It must be said, not far from the end, though not quite there yet. The book had been swallowed up by his recliner and forgotten about just before his life got busy again. Now he read until he reached the end. Then he closed the book, knowing that his professor in advanced religion would be pleased. He had finished the Gita before dying.